Blog Talk Radio.
Friday night I crashed your party.
The radio order.
Saturday I said I'm sorry. Sunday came and crashed me out again. I was only having fun.
Who do you want to talk to? Yeah. Alright. Come over to the flag. Let us think of a walk on Blind Talk Radio. So we need to get a call us, man. Alright, let's turn all the mics on.
Period of time, and he'll be here in the studio.
That's terrific.
So let's kick off. We've got big news this week. We've got a state Supreme Court decision in which 8 new districts are to be drawn after Thursday. The Florida Supreme Court ruled, quote, the districting process and resulting map for the districts were tainted by unconstitutional intent to favor the Republican Party and incumbents, wrote Justice Barbara Pariente in the court's majority opinion. The districts to be affected by the ruling are Tampa Bay Area District 13, where David Jolly sits, 14, where Kathy Castor sits, Northeast Florida's vertically swiveling District 5, where Corrine Brown is in, which actually cuts through, I think, 5 counties, and then the Boca Raton 21, where Democrat Peter Deutsch is, and 22, where Democrat Lois Frankel sits, and the 25th, which stretches all the way from Miami to Fort Myers, where Mario Diaz-Balart is, who, of course, was one of the people fighting against the measure, and then the far south District 26 of Republican Carlos Cabello, and southeastern 27, which is Republican Aina Ross Latinian.
District 14 is affected with Buchanan as well.
No, it's 16 is Buchanan. I don't think it is affected.
No, 16 will not be one of the districts that are redrawn.
No.
Not by this decision.
14.
No, 13 is, which is Jolly's. Now, 13 is his old one, but that is now Jolly's district. But the 14 was one of them, yes.
Well, it's, the write-up I have from the Herald Tribune indicates that the newly shaped District 14 could cause changes in adjacent districts represented by Buchanan.
Well, the problem is that some of the other ones that have to be redrawn could affect other ones that don't. You see what I mean? Right. So you have
all over the place.
Right. There's going to be a ripple effect here because you have these districts were ordered as unconstitutional, so they have to be redrawn. But when you redraw a district, obviously, if it's not at the same boundaries, you're going to have to impact the surrounding boundaries. So you might have in these, you might have 30 districts that are ultimately, all of the districts in Florida might ultimately be impacted to some degree. So it's going to be interesting. But the most important part, you know, the state Supreme Court got it right in and by looking at this, which was so clearly gerrymandered, so clearly not done in a democratic fashion, and so clearly in opposition to the intent of the Fair Districts Act, which was overwhelmingly passed by voters who said, listen, very, you know, basic premise of democracy, the voters should choose their leaders, not the other way around. The leaders should not choose their voters. Corrine Brown's district, I think, was the most egregious of all of these. You know, you look at it, and it snakes through five different counties, little tiny swatches and slivers and paths everywhere, and the idea that you can get representative democracy, that you can get a real constituency in a community, it's absurd.
Well, Dennis, the thing that's about is mainly to pack that district with black people, so that and it was made to make Corrine Brown feel comfortable that she could be guaranteed a seat down the road because of the packing. But it hurt all sides of the coin when you do that. And while she was comfortable and is upset with the call by the Supreme Court, especially, which overrode the district court, is what's interesting. So the yelling is going on. The original gerrymandering was created with the conservative Democrats in the past, back in the 70s, and Lawton Child's time. So now,
yeah, there is. Listen, this is a bipartisan issue. Everybody is guilty of it. Everybody tries to get control of it by the time of the census. They try to get it redrawn in their favor, and that's the whole point of the Fair Districts. That's why it got bipartisan support. Because at the end of the day, I think the people want it to be. Most people, anyway, want it to be a competition of ideas, not a let's just, you know, carve it out, let's give a party power. One party rule hasn't worked anywhere in the world ever. Go anywhere.
We have Florida has so much in common with the state of Illinois from the opposite side. I was bringing up the issue of the conservatives who became. There's conservative Democrats who...
Right, but even liberal Democrats, you have to acknowledge, even liberal Democrats are guilty of it. Nobody has ever said, let's just fairly do this, which is why, listen, the other big important thing that we've talked about, we had a paper editorial about this a few weeks ago, is look at the United States Supreme Court decision with Arizona allowing and saying, yes, it is constitutional to take this power away from the legislature, appoint these nonpartisan commissions and have them draw districts, because at the end of the day, a district should be a community. That way someone has a representative. If we all live in the same neighborhood and we have the same issues and we take the same roads to our kids go to the same school system, we take the same highways to work, we have the same, you know, waters that might rise up and flood our streets, we should have, when we have the commonality of challenges and problems and joint interests, we should have a representative that we all go to. But if I live, you know, two blocks away from Augie and he lives four blocks away from Mitch, and we've got three different representatives because it behooved them to cut the lines through different areas like that, what it does is it waters down democracy. It inhibits the three of us getting together and going down to our representative's office and saying, hey, we want change. Instead, the three of us got to take three different trips, go three different places, and we don't have we have a watered-down appearance. And that's the whole intent, I believe.
What happened in Texas this last redistricting, they took the city of Austin, which is a kind of like a Democratic stronghold in Texas, and always had a Democratic congressman. They took that district and they divided it up. They gave this little piece to this district, to like five different districts, and basically broke up all the Democrats so they wouldn't have a significant vote. So now there is no Democrat elected.
Yeah, you take a third of them and put them in each of the three districts.
In five ways. And I do want to make an announcement. The phone line for 941-745 is now 1490 is busy, and we're busy for the show. We have an auxiliary number, so if you'd like to call, listen carefully. It's 347-989-0132. That's 347-989-0132. And if you just want to listen to the show, there's 1,000 phone lines there. You can just call and listen, and if you want to participate, hit the 1 button.
So, listen, this is something that...
I'm going to call back on that line, so I'm going to cut off and try that line and see if it works so people can find out how that does work. But I'll call in on that line instead of holding up this other line, 941-745-1490. I'll call back.
All right, Argy.
So you know, that's an opportunity Florida has. Florida can switch to a nonpartisan commission. Now, of course, the devil's in the details on this, as we said in the editorial, because who's going to appoint the commission? And Florida has not had a good record of, when you look at the appointments, staff appointments, any of those things, Florida does not exactly have a sterling record. But if you could get honest people in there, if you can get the best and the brightest and say, hey, listen, let's draw up these districts in a way that's fair, that's equitable, that is representative, and that just makes sense. It's not that hard. And, you know, we do it with precincts. There are people with expertise in these areas that you could put in there. Maybe you even take some retired supervisors of elections, people who have dealt with this that know what it's like, boots on the ground, to conduct an election.
Bipartisan,
absolute, nonpartisan, really. What you want is you want the idea.
Is there such a thing?
Well, you know, I think there is to some extent.
If the commission's of 10 people, 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans.
Maybe, you know, and that's one way to look at
independents.
Yeah, I think, you know, look.
But what independents are active?
You get some people. I guess what you have to look at is there are people that, you know, you just look at their history, and they're more political than others. And they spent their life brokering political favors, and they have, you know, made a career and a livelihood out of kind of horse trading with the political system. There are other people that are more bureaucratic in nature that have experience with the functionality of government. And I think sometimes those are the people that you want for positions like this. You know, the one thing I always try to remind people, and this comes up in almost every conversation, especially when you get into, you know, ideologues, you know, debating an issue, is that there is no playbook that you just follow. There is no, you always do this. A, you know, happens, you always do B. C happens, you always do D. If anybody in the history of the world had ever gotten it right, if there had ever been a secret recipe, it would have been discovered and we'd all have the same form of government and we'd all be living in a utopia. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that. And we need to start having more intelligent debate about the issues at hand and get away from the politicization of it. And what these districts do is the opposite. They ensure that we don't have to have actual honest intellectual debate. They allow us to just continue having the politicization of every issue.
It goes further than that because you end up with extremely, and it could be left wing, but right now it's leaning right wing. You have these extreme right wing districts, and then you have the extreme right wing from the Tea Party saying to a moderate Democrat, or Republican rather, if you vote that way, we will primary you, so you're going to get somebody who's even more extreme.
Oh, there's no question. There's no question, especially in Florida, that the center has been moved drastically right. There's no question about that. And
excuse me, Dennis, I'm trying to call in right now. Can I have
you're
on the line.
You're in, buddy. You're in.
Okay, good. I didn't know. I think Dennis is making a huge point here. There's a tendency to think in terms of party. I believe in open primaries is a big solution to some of the problems. Florida is and Illinois have so much in common. They're one party states, and when you have one, and Tallahassee runs Florida, it's up there in the northwest corner. Whatever party gets in power there and holds it and ignores the center of the state, which is Orlando, which is where the capital needs to be, or somewhere in that vicinity. The same thing's true in Illinois. Chicago, in the northeast corner of that state, runs the entire state. The state's 600 miles long, and Florida's even longer if you go to Key West, 1,200 miles, I think. But it's impossible to get representation in a live sit in the legislature and listen to and argue with your representatives and get your case made. There's no work being made. And if you read the Florida Constitution, the Constitution in the state of Florida requires that it be in the center of the population. That was the original intent, and it's ignored. Nobody goes after it. I bring it up to leaders all the time. Nobody wants to do any work in that regard.
Yeah, make it a museum. Make the Capitol Museum, move it to Orlando. But devil's advocate on that, look at New York. You might think that New York City would dominate the state, that the Capitol would be there, and that the rest of that big, large, you know, mostly rural state would fall by the wayside. But you had Albany that's up there in the center, and for years and years it was nothing but the most corrupt government, probably the most corrupt state government of the 50 for quite some time.
Well, when you if in Illinois, the capital is not Chicago. The capital is Springfield.
No, I understand, but what I'm saying is the capital wasn't Manhattan. It was Albany, and it didn't get any better.
I know. Well,
but maybe because it's Albany, the rest of New York gets represented.
The party primaries, I think, are the culprit in large measure. Because if you could vote for people on the basis of who you wanted in, right now the fastest growing portion of voters is moving to the independent status. They're waiting for the general election to pick and choose. And, of course, the one thing that Trump is flirting with and hinting at, and right now Fox News has stated he's got to do a finance report or he's not going to be on that stage, no matter what his poll numbers are. So they're already trying to shake him loose from that podium. In any event, if you're going to have this kind of one party gets gets its own news station on a cable network and the other party's left out, and we decide which of the top 10 polling, we got all this maneuvering because of party. But here the independents, if Trump decides to go an independent, he's going to do a Ross Perot on the Republican Party big time. This is where. So this whole thing, depending on how it's structured, it's important what the Florida Supremes have done. But if we don't make use of that and get some more things done, it's just going to just be repeated problem after problem.
Well, there's probably some truth to that. Let's move on to our other big issue this week. We've got a movement now in Florida. It looks that South Carolina's state house passed yesterday the resolution to get rid of the flag, and it looks like it might be down by the weekend. So now the Senate and the House
are coming down at 10 a.m. this morning.
At 10 a.m., okay. So you've got both of those. Now you have a movement in Florida to start removing the flag. Let me tell you what I saw. I was driving back from Savannah on Sunday. I had to launch my new novel that's out, and which is set there. And when
we should talk about that later.
shameless plug. But when we were driving back from Savannah, we were coming across I-10, and on a bridge that runs on an overpass through some rural area just around Starkey, you had about 30 Floridians standing on that bridge holding giant Confederate flags, or the Army of Northern Virginia flags that we call the Confederate flag, hanging them over the bridge so that all the passerbys had to see it, and hooting and hollering, and, you know, this is our flag, it's not going anywhere. You know, so it shows that those feelings are alive and well, and that is a I think what we're showing, you know, you and I talked about this a few weeks back when, you know, shootings happened, the mass murder in South Carolina, on top of all of the racial incidents that we've had with white police forces in the United States, and this kind of bubbling over of racial tensions, and how we really felt like, you know, we were at a critical juncture in maybe things weren't as good as we had thought they had been. Maybe a lot of this was just beneath the surface and starting to get scratched open. And now this flag seems to be pointing in that direction as well. You know, this issue where people are clinging to this, you know, this icon that when you go back to the Confederate flag, like I said, it's not even the actual flag of the Confederacy. It was associated with some states because it was I think the Northern Virginia militia, it was their flag. But this flag did not get rolled back out, let's remember, until the late 1950s and early 60s with the Civil Rights Movement and with opposition to integration of schools and so forth. So when you look at this and say this is part of heritage, there's a lot that disputes that and says it's something a little bit more menacing.
Well,
so
but
I think
Dennis, you're on to, here's a critical point of what you're making, I really think. And that is that the teaching in the South has been, the Civil War was a war of aggression, the North aggressing against the South. And the song Dixie, Dixieland, and so forth is a very nostalgic song. Look away, look away. Do not look at that national flag, that federalism of Washington. That is what aggressed against us. That's what changed our way of life and all of the above. The $4 to $5 billion in its own time, sales of black flesh for black flesh and trading and auctioning from the auction blocks of the South, in Charleston in particular, was so financially beneficial to not just the cotton industry, but to a lot of other things, construction and everything else. Black flesh was used to build Washington, D.C., and parts of New York. So the selling of bodies and trading, and then the Fugitive Slave Act, where they allowed, and where Harriet Beecher Stowe, my great aunt, wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, because that was all about the Fugitive Slave Act, chasing blacks that ran north over the Ohio River at that time. That's what her novel's about, is what that whole business became. And if you have that understanding, that they wanted the Fugitive Slave Act to force the northern states to join the South, secession was about pulling states from the Union, even not just in the 22 states of the South, but even more. That's what was at stake. So the flag represents a lost war to maintain and promote slavery.
Well, I mean, if you say it was about more than slavery, which a lot of people will give, you got to remember that the Civil War itself was an act of treason. You know, when people say states' rights, listen, it was an act of treason against the Republic. A war was fought to quell the treason, to quell the secession, and it did. And that war was surrendered.
We have a caller.
Yes. We have Lawrence on the line.
Okay, does Lawrence
make a
have a question?
Comment, please?
Sure.
All right, go ahead, Lawrence.
Is it not factual that the flag went up in South Carolina under Governor Ernest Hollings? And
who was
now,
a Democrat.
Oh, good point there, August. And
Nikki Haley,
hey, by the way, August, attacking the messenger doesn't negate the fact that I'm pointing out that you neglect
but I'm
to
simply,
point out.
I'm making an agreeable comment is all I'm doing.
Yeah, I know. I understand. You make a lot of them on your show, don't you?
Lawrence, you're attacking the host. So if you want to make a point,
I'm
going to hang up on you.
The only caller is being attacked.
Go ahead, Lawrence. What was your point?
My point is a Democrat put it up and a Republican pulled it down. And that's something that you wouldn't hear on your left show.
Well, okay. Whatever you want to call it.
There's
show,
no
you
argument
can to do that.
Go ahead.
Nikki Haley, is it Haley is her last name, right?
Haley, yes.
I said when she made her announcement that she would be the greatest vice presidential choice for the Republicans that they could have possibly picked if they do choose to do that. I think that would be the smartest.
Okay, but there was a Republican that pulled it down, August, and a Democrat that put it up. Talk about that.
Well, you're right. I've already gave compliments to Governor Haley, and I even recommended she become a vice presidential candidate. What more do you want me to say, Lawrence?
Well, quit knocking the Republicans
but
now. Put it up.
Lawrence, nobody even mentioned the word Republican. We're talking about a flag issue.
Really? As you divert and bash Republicans.
Have we found the word Republican at all? There hasn't been the word Republican in the flag issue at all.
Hey, pass the Kool-Aid.
All right,
there you go. There you go.
Thanks for the call, Lawrence. Thank you for the call.
Goodbye, Lawrence.
Lawrence pointed out yesterday, the Republican governor, after a radical right wing terrorist went into a black African American church into a prayer group and murdered in a cold blooded act of terrorism a group of innocent people. Then, yes, finally, at that point, and after some hemming and hawing, finally, at that point, the Confederate flag, which is not a flag of that state, which is not a flag of our Union, which is not recognized in any way, that was flying at their capital, was finally taken down. So I applaud what would seem like complete common sense at that point. You know, when you look at this, and I had a column last Sunday, when you look at this idea and you say, well, that's not what we mean by it. Imagine if Germany started flying a Nazi flag in one of their state buildings and said, well, you know, look, There it is. There the swastika is an old pagan symbol. It means more things than the Nazi Party, and it still is part of our history. Might not be the best part of our history, but it's still part of our history. And the Nazis, as misguided as they may have been, you know, they were part of, you know, really what their message was they didn't like the reparations that had to be paid after World War One and the economic state to put Germany in. If they started trying to explain to the people of the world why they were flying their flag at a state institution, we would justifiably be repulsed by it. Now, anyone that they want, those people, I was repulsed when I was driving down the highway and saw that flag flying, you know, in full mast from the bridge. But I don't deny the people's rights to do that anymore. If somebody wants to fly a swastika flag like that outside their house, I'm repulsed by it. I'll denounce it. But that's their free First Amendment protected right. But when you're talking about a state house, that's something very different. That's the government. That's paid for by taxes from people who have all colors of skin and race and
right.
religious beliefs and creeds. So when you look at that and say, well, it doesn't mean that to us, that would seem absurd. Do you know many people who wear black skin that say, well, I'm not offended by that? No, and rightfully so. This was the flag that was used as the official colors of the color guard in ceremonies of the KKK when they performed lynchings. So when you look at that and you say, well, it doesn't mean that to us, well, listen, they took that off you. If it was a symbol of states' rights, which I don't recall it ever really being, like I said, it was pretty much in the dustbin until the late 1950s and early 60s, and where you started seeing it all the time were at rallies to say, keep them at the lunch counters, keep them not drinking from our water fountains, and Lord be, don't put them in the school.
Symbol of the anti-civil rights movement.
Absolutely. That's where it became popular with the South, and that was the state right that they have historically seen. When you look at states like Alabama, you look at states like Mississippi, the state's right that they have historically seen most concerned with preserving has been the separation of the races.
Right, and I want to say that the governor, the Democratic governor, it's not a full label. The conservative Democratic governor, because that governor was a conservative at the time, most Democrats in the South at the time were conservatives. It was into the 70s, and Reagan finally brought the rest of them home in the 80s, that the conservative Democrats switched to the Republican Party.
And where did they lose them? When Johnson said this will cost us the Democratic, this will cost us the South for generations.
Right.
And that's what it was. When true Democrats said, no, finally, we're going to move forward with actual every man is created equal in this country.
Dennis, you guys are making the great point, and for the real shame was that Lincoln, who was an abolitionist, his Lincoln-Douglas debates demonstrated that. He welcomed Harriet Beecher Stowe into the White House because they were trying to get money for the clothing for the Union Army, and the industrialists and those who made the clothing came in there because the wives had listened to her talk about her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which a lot of people do not understand at all. It was Tom was ordered to beat another slave to death for a punishment, and so he refused, and he was beaten to death in turn. But in any event, she came there to the White House, and he announced, this is the little lady that will start the Civil War, for her book. Her book was in 356 plays worldwide, and it was all about what the Republican Party could do to bring the country together under Lincoln. The Transcontinental Railroad was another effort at the time of the war. And this man, Lincoln, is spinning in his grave as he thinks about the craziness that the Southerners now occupy and control. There's Southern conservatives occupy and control the Republican Party and make a joke out of the Emancipation Proclamation and everything else that Lincoln said. I mean, it is bizarre at best. Even Perry, the governor, who's kind of strange in his own way from Texas, said the 14th Amendment and the way we treat blacks is an insult to Lincoln. So he's just said that about a week ago. This whole business is designed to for white superiority and the betrayal of Lincoln, the betrayal of civil rights by the Southern faction in this country to try to keep equal but separate in place is what's going on here. This is really a shame to this country, and this excuse that your party did it at one time and we're better than that at this time is a silliness that just is unimaginable.
You're right. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. And you know, to bring it full circle, what this gets to, what all the things we're talking about get to, all the way back then, all the way through the 60s, all the way to today, is really economic inequality. And what I mean by that is when you look at the South after the Civil War, through Reconstruction, and you had a completely decimated economy, you had a completely a tattered social class. They clung to the idea of heritage. They clung to the idea of family, class, history, and so forth. And when you look at the history of that time, inclusivity threatened that. And when you looked at the idea that at least we'll keep this system where we run the governments, we run the bureaucracy, we run the jobs, we control the society, that in essence, still created an oppression that wasn't that much different than slavery. Slaves were freed, but then limited so much with their economic opportunity that they were, in essence, still slaves to an extent. So when you have that, you end up with the same kind of hatred and you end up with the same kind of divisiveness that you had in Germany. You know, a lot of people will go back and say the biggest mistake the Allies made after World War One was in enacting such harsh and drastic reparations because it was an economic impossibility. There was no way at that point after World War One, Germany was going to be anything other than an impoverished nation, a failed state, tattered economy, and it would be a breeding ground for that kind of extremism. Now, that's interesting because that takes us to another issue we should talk about, Alki, and that is Greece this week. And Greece
you're ringing my bell.
Let me ask you what you think of that, Augie. So Greece's perspective is we forgave a tremendous amount of German debt post-World War II. And
I'm right with you.
It was the only thing that was able allowed you to continue to grow your economy. We think that you should do the same thing right now. And a lot of economists are looking at it and saying that it's a completely unsustainable reality to try to make Greece borrow more money to pay back money that they couldn't pay back in the first place and never should have been lent, that Germany has to do that. What's your thoughts, Augie?
Actually, they've already paid the principal back two or three times. What they're trying to collect is what the accumulated interest is, because they've not just missed their first payment.
The profit on the money.
The profit on the money. And who benefits the banks? Who gets hurt if that isn't paid? Well, I say pay them over the next 50 to 100 years, but end up cutting that thing in half, because in 1953, and Merkel knows this, Germany was West Germany and East Germany. The western side got the debt cut in half in 53, and therefore their growth took off, making them a miracle of turning around from the devastation. I traveled in Germany, in Europe, in 1956 and 58, and I saw it firsthand. I was in buildings that were bombed out, and the destruction was amazing. And last year I was in Berlin, so I saw the recovery there. But in 56 and 58, I was there as a kid, and I witnessed this stuff I was there a pretty extended time with my father, who was German. In any event, we as a Christian nation, we brag about being a Christian nation. I mean, we can't do forgiveness, and we want to yell and tell, and the Europeans, Germany especially, as you said right away, Dennis, they look like hypocrites. But they're being pushed by, ironically, Denmark and Norway, who want every nickel collected. And England is the other culprit. England and all of the big banks and so forth are located there. That's where the money is, and they're cooperating. The Troika, which is England, France, and Germany, are the ones
demanding. France wants forgiveness, actually, under Hollande, and you're going to see that push a little louder, I think, as time wears on. But there's a deal in the cooker as we're talking right now, because the head of Greece, Tsipras, has gone forward with some of the agreements, but he wants forgiveness, and that's what's going to have to happen. They have pension reform that's in their problem. The pensions, the average pensions are at 58 years of age. They can retire, and they want to raise it up, I don't know, 59 or some not a big amount. And Americans go nuts when they have these six-week vacations and all this. That's what a socialist pact is. That's what Social Security is. You want to give up your Social Security when you're at a certain age, or you want to be 90 before you collect it? I mean, you know, anyway, this little country, if you lose Greece in the European mix, you invite Russia in, who's creating real problems in the Baltic.
Yes, they're already working around the sniffing the blood in that situation. But listen, so you really have two issues here. You have an interesting thing that came out this week, too, is Thomas Piketty, who wrote that surprise big hit book last year. He's one of the most foremost economists in the world. He wrote Capital in the 21st Century, which kind of
right.
shook the grounds of the education industry, which has come to be dominated by your Wall Street-type investment capital believers, that kind of religious belief that the market, you know, solves everything. Thomas Piketty kind of derailed a lot of those modern premises last year, but he spoke on this issue and he brought up a really interesting point. And he said that we're forgetting in this issue that debt is an investment, and an investment implies risk. And he said, so this idea now that if you make someone a loan and you make a bad loan, the punishment in the market, so to speak, used to be that you risked your capital and you may have lost it when they couldn't repay the loan. The idea that you can make someone a loan, you can make them another loan, each loan progressively worse than the other, loans you shouldn't make that aren't smart investments on the lender's part, maybe not fair or equitable investments, we should say, and then when the inevitable conclusion arises that the loan fails, instead of losing your investment, you're able to instead put them over the coal, rake them over the coals, and say, this is what we're going to do to you to make sure. These are the what we're going to implement in your country to make sure you pay us back. That's something different in the terms of historically the way debt and loans have been leveraged as an investment. But the other part of it is when you look at a great book on this one would be Michael Lewis's Boomerang. Of course, he wrote the great book on the collapse of the financial markets, and then came back with some leftovers that he had and wrote this shorter kind of little pamphlet book called Boomerang, and he went into Greece extensively, and there is evidence that there's some unsustainable bureaucratic practices in Greece. So there needs to be maybe some acknowledgement that they can't afford some of their social welfare at this point. Not to say that they should have anywhere near the kind of stringent belt-tightening that they're talking about in this instance, but you probably have a little bit of both. But we're only hearing one side. We're hearing the side that, you know, we should be able to come in and enact all these changes because you're not paying your loan back. That takes away the risk element of debt, and it makes it then that everyone's kind of like the IMF used to be with third world countries. We'll lend you all kinds of money that we know you can't pay back, because the punishment for not paying it back is the real return on our investment.
Let me just say something, Augie. What does Germany offer to Greece? Are they offering, you do these reforms, we're going to come in here and put in investment, we're going to put in factories there, is there any economic stimulus they're offering? They're not offering any economic stimulus.
Well,
it should be two-way street here.
Well, the thing that Greece offers primarily is tourism, and they're a vehicle for passing money through to different parts of the world. I mean, they're the bridge. You lose that bridge, as little as it may seem to be, you can't get from point A to point B quite the same way you could before. Realize this, the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church are married politically as religions and in a lot of other ways. And once Russia gets hold of that, they get that bridge, they can bargain with the world using Greek to do it, and the debt will not get paid at all. So this yelling and screaming by the banks, pay us back, pay us back, pay us every damn nickel, is the dishonesty that's in this bargain.
It reminds me of the bailout, when Bush bailed out the banks, and even Obama took over, and they're paying their top executives billions of dollars in bonuses, while the rest of the taxpayers are looking at $1 trillion heading towards the
bank. AIG, you remember that?
Right.
The AIG, that's right. Exactly right. And that, this is the stuff that makes people get furious. And, you know, where did Jesse James come from? We made a hero out of him because he was a hero. Because he told the banks, you took my farm, I'm going to break your banks down, I'm going to take your money back. You stole it from me, and I'm going to steal it back. And that's Jesse James. A whole raft of people in the 30s did what they did because of the lawyers, the bankers, and the people in government who conspired to break everybody, the middle and below. The attack of the crash of 05, 06, 07, 08 was one of attacking the middle and breaking the middle down, squeeze every nickel out of them, foreclose on them, whatever you have to do. Countrywide Homes was bought up by Bank of America, knowing that they could squeeze nickels down the road. It was an investment in bankruptcy of the people. And this is an attack on the people by the bankers and those who are married intellectually, spiritually, and politically to the banks. So when I hear people make excuses on the basis of party, and they don't want to look at this problem in that way, they really don't really give a damn about the poor. And that is a condemnation of this society as a people, excusing things because one party did it one time one way and another does it another.
And it's not going to change because you have, I've said this before, my biggest knock, I don't have many complaints about the Obama presidency. There's a lot of things I think he could have did better. But my biggest one is that he had the historic opportunity when he sat there with his in 2009, and they were ready to repent to some degree, and the response was that you basically have a PR problem. You have an acute PR problem, gentlemen. And he had the opportunity to say, we've got the will of the people, we've got the historic, follow the markets, we have a moment here where we're going to reform and fix. And I think that was a once-in-a-100-year storm where you would have had the opportunity to break too big to fail, to redefine the way we do work with capital investment lending in this country, to put back in place some reasonable and equitable regulation that has been lost, all in the name of making more dynamic markets, whatever exactly that means. It usually just means that somebody gets a bigger bonus and there's more risk that's subsidized by the public taxpayer. But we had that opportunity to do that. We missed it. And I think that was it's going to be looked back at a huge failure in history. And when you look now, both people are taking, if you have Hillary Clinton as Democratic nominee and then whoever you get as Republican, that would mean that no one would be standing up to Wall Street in any way whatsoever because they're both married at the hip to that money in downtown New York.
Unless party gets enough momentum.
Ironically, term limits to me are the real culprit. And what I mean by that is the 22nd Amendment, which was put in 48 by the Republican Party, limiting the term of the presidency to two terms because of the fact that FDR, had they done that in World War II, we would have probably lost the damn war thanks to the Republicans. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. And the two-term presidency is a six-year presidency. It's worth the first 2 years.
I've advocated for a long time, Augie. I think we should do one six-year term.
I would say better than that. Make it 2 6-year terms. Whatever. Then the guy's not going to be lame duck.
But you still got a couple years. You still have a little bit of lame duck, and you still have a re-election. I like the idea of having a president.
Dennis, you're talking about the here and the now. Remember, FDR got elected 3-4 times, and he carried through the Depression and World War II. And we won the vote effectively. And he did it by everybody going to work under World War II demands.
Okay, so 6 years one way or the other, but maybe one or two. But at the end of the day, I still think it's the re-election part that that hurts it, is that you have a big cycle in which you're looking and saying, well, I'm going to have to run again. And then a lot can happen in that period where they're kind of, you know, running with one leg tied up against their knee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyhow,
I agree with Dennis.
Yeah, term limits guarantee incompetency. You can't, by the time you figure out what you did wrong, your time
Absolutely, this doesn't work because you've got two things. Now you've got two things. You have a term limit with saying that it's you guarantee a lame duck period, and you have a re-election. So almost half of an 8-year establishment is tied up in those two dynamics.
Right. So anyhow, the 22nd Amendment should be abolished in my book, and let people be reelected on the basis of love or hate. And get the open primaries, and then you start to choose people on the basis of quality. And I say hooray for Donald Trump, because they're scared to death of him. Now they made a new stipulation that he has to show his financial records or he's not going to go on the stage. The Republicans are really getting terrified of this guy, and I think with good reason. So where do you come down on that, Dennis?
Well, you know, I think that there is the aspect that now you have to define yourself against Donald Trump. There are a lot of people saying, hey, don't look over here, don't look over here, we don't take him seriously. But when you have that much of your party saying, hey, what he's saying makes sense, you have a nice big chunk of Republicans who are saying, I don't disagree with Donald Trump. That is a problem for the party, because now they've got to either distance themselves from that or continue to try to ignore it. At some point, someone has to answer about being different. Now, the question will be,
he could win the primary.
I don't think so, but I think he. I don't think he can win it, but I think he can be a factor in making it go different directions than it would go without him being in it. I think he can really have an impact on who does win the primary. I don't think he can win it. But here's what I'll tell you that we should look for. Let's go back to 2008, okay? There were two people kept out of the primary, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich. They both qualified to be in the debates. Kucinich got into one, I think Paul got into one that year, and then they were out. Why they weren't allowed there is because they disrupted the narrative. You had Ron Paul on stage talking about protectionism, talking about inflation, talking about isolationism, not going out on these military adventures, and that disrupted what was considered the Reagan-esque candidates and their narrative on conservatism. They couldn't say it with a straight face if Ron Paul was allowed to rebut them. You also couldn't have a very moderate Democrat in President Obama running as a progressive or being painted and smeared as a rabid left-wing liberal.
We have a caller.
You couldn't have either of those things.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, because
we have Chuck from New Bedford.
Can you hear me today?
Yes.
All right. Well, that's why.
Chuck from New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Possibly the call is about how we're going to callous the banks.
So what is on your mind?
But I was considering the only thing when they have the other chance that was missing. I was breaking the bands that you were talking about was also the chance to turn the country green, because when they had the automotive companies under their wing and they bailed them out, that was the opportunity to force them to go all the way.
Well, I would say that I think that was an area where he did as well as he could. If you look at – that was the first time in 25 years that we raised CAFE standards under President Obama.
Yeah, but we should be loving that. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, they recently redid a convenience store gas pump in my neighborhood. It's called Cumberland Farms. They pump Gulf gas. Now, at that time period, I've been advocating electric cars, talking about the same kind of thing. That's about the time this was going on in reference to the bailout for the automotive industry. And I'm saying, why are they allowing new gas tanks to go into the ground when they should be being phased out? Well, since that time, they put in two new gas stations, Cumberland Farms, in my city. Gas stations should be going the way of whale oil, okay? We should be moving away. We're talking about fossil fuels. You're right down there in the Gulf. They're pumping.
I don't disagree with you at all. So let me ask you a question. What pace do you think they should be at in terms of how much Like I said, they've made progress. I think, unlike the banking, they actually meaningfully leveraged it. But where do you think?
No, they didn't. That's my point. My point is they didn't meaningfully leverage it because they already had CAFE. They might have, you know.
Well, they reached the play standards.
Their thumb. They said that they had.
Uh-huh.
They could have went bankrupt. So all
okay.
The Ford would have went bankrupt if the government didn't bail them out. So the government could have said, all electric. Electric was feasible.
All electric? So that's my question. Is it, so your answer would have been go 100% electric at that point?
Yeah. It'd be like, yeah. Well, it might have taken them 5 years to do it, but they could have forced them to do it. Just kind of like say, hey, let's put a man on the moon. Nobody's doing that. What's happening in sustainability is everybody's is very la-la about it. I'm seeing even the best candidate we have today, Bernie Sanders, he keeps talking about building infrastructure. He's talking about 1960s and 70s infrastructure. He's talking about rebuilding highways. You know, I see all kinds of Obama money spent on to stimulate everything. And all what do? They made all the intersections wider for what? Automobiles. Wrong infrastructure. We need to go on electric rail tiers of transportation. We need to rebuild our housing that revolves around those tiers. Instead of people living out in the rural areas consuming, you know, individual cars, and it was a wrong build-out, you know. We need attitude about bicycles. I have a German national with a temporary border in my house. Let me just
caller. I think you've got a real point with the rail issue. I think everything can't be done at once. But if you're going to do your infrastructure, you've got to provide for rail, whichever kind of rail you want to talk about.
Well, all kinds of rail. That's my point. We need to be thinking about a non-automotive centric civilization.
Well, that's if you realize and know that the interstate highway system was built at the median in the center was supposed to be rail. Whatever kind you want to make it, that is what the intent was in the original design.
And that's something I've been saying. We should have solar panels along the highways, and we should have tracks going up and down them. And in the parking lots, there should be good light rail getting you to the main. You know, I-95 should be a rail system. There should be a rail that goes all the major systems should be converted to rail, and people should rent cars. Buy, you know, if you have to go from, you know, 400 miles or something, you don't take your personal car. You take the rail. Then you.
I don't disagree with you at all. When people talk about the cost of rail, when you look at the cost of highways, that's what we discount from the automotive infrastructure, is that we look at it and we say, well, it costs so much. Look what Amtrak has to get subsidized. Well, look at what the car grid has to get subsidized just with the Federal Highway Fund every year. I don't disagree with you. Now, I will play devil's advocate a little bit. Because you have to look at it from the economic perspective. When you looked at when they were on the verge of bankruptcy, we couldn't let them fail. What people didn't realize was there was another million jobs tied up with General Motors in ancillary jobs that go along with all the things from.
But again, they're building the wrong thing.
I understand. I understand. Hold on. Let me make my point. What I'm saying, I don't disagree with you. You're working on a dinosaur. I'm not disagreeing. But at a time when your economy is in a fragile state, teetering, you know, 11-12% unemployment, if you're going to say, well, we're going to go over to the system now that's less labor intensive, we're going to erase a million more jobs on the people that contribute to this business. It is a problem. There is a problem that so much of our paychecks are tied into practices that aren't sustainable.
The only thing is, I would say this, you know, the war on sustainability is a war that people aren't really fighting. You talked about FDR getting through those three, you know, the extra terms and what he overcame. And that's because he rallied a mission, and people didn't say what my profit was. They went to making profits. And if they did, they need to do the same thing with sustainability. The economy will fall into place. What's backwards in this country and in capitalism in general is the fact that they look at the bottom dollar as opposed to the mission. Money's supposed to keep track of what's going on. It's not supposed to be the reason for what's going on. And
that's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with the caller.
Did the caller give his name, Dennis?
It's Chuck Dade.
Chuck, it's great for your voice. I'm going to leave the show right now because I've got to make a trip on our feeble third world rail system going to Portland, Oregon.
Really?
Eventually.
Probably less than that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Augie. You have a good and safe trip, and thank you, Chuck, for calling. Yeah. We appreciate it. Enjoy Amtrak, Chuck.
Good job, Mitch. Good job. See you and talk to you, Dennis. I want to talk to you about some more things down the road.
You got it. All right. So, hey, listen, some good news this week is that California now has two solar farms that are producing as much as the equivalent fossil fuel energy plants. So electricity has a competitor. So there are now two plants in California. This is a big victory, Mitch. When you look at, I know myself, my own skepticism, listen, at the end of the day, solar has to be, you know, the answer, the solution in the end.
Do you know solar right now employs almost twice as many people as the coal industry?
Yes.
Do you also know in 2014, more solar was installed in the United States than in the previous 30 years? And in the first 5 months of 2015, more solar was installed than in 2014.
So an amazing victory. So what I'm saying is 5 years ago, I would, and most solar people wouldn't have said we'd be as far as we are right now. We've had some pleasant surprises in technological innovation. So I was just talking to my son about this the other day when he was asking me the difference. Sullivan's here with us. And he was asking me, what's the difference between a hybrid, an electric, or these new plug-in hybrids? And we're talking about it. And, you know, the reality is now you have electric vehicles. You have cars that you can just run off batteries, but they have, you know, limited range. The range, however, has tripled since the cars have put on the market. So now you can get up to about 150 miles, you know, on a charge. The batteries, which were big, clunky, and extremely expensive, have now gone down in about the same 300% margin. So the batteries are cheaper, they last longer, they charge faster.
Well,
so
Tesla is putting an infrastructure off the highways.
Mm-hmm.
There's one right off of Sarasota on University. They're in the mall. But they have a charging station, so if you have a Tesla.
They do, and then there's another one in downtown Lakewood Ranch, there's
right.
one in downtown Palmetto, there's one in downtown Bradenton.
Well, it's Tesla's.
Oh, Tesla's.
Or their car.
Got it.
It will recharge your car in 15 minutes, and you'll be able to go about another 210 miles.
So that was that's
much longer than it takes to fill your tank.
Right. So that's the other part. So the question back then was, well, how will this ever become practical? And the answer was obvious. The batteries will get better, the batteries will charge faster, and they'll last longer, and it'll be cheaper to replace when they go. We're seeing that right now at a rate we never really could have fathomed even a couple of years back. And why? Because the demand is driving technology. So there are some things that we're going to have to look at. There's, so, like I said before, there is so much of our economy tied up to unsustainable practices. There's so many jobs and paychecks that revolve around that. But solar has been the great victory. Like you said, twice as many people in the United States taking home a paycheck not related to a dirty
solar.
Carbon fuel. So twice as many as coal. Not nobody has to go. I've never heard of a solar plant accident. I've never heard of 200 people getting buried in a solar mine.
Exactly.
So save solar jobs.
It was a solar spill today.
Nobody gets a check for solar lung.
Actually, in the 80s, I had my own solar business.
Oh, you did?
We installed over 2,000 solar hot water systems in southern New England.
So you have
many of them are still there.
You have a good understanding, then, of what the technology has, the leaps and bounds
and
that
about
we've made.
4 or 5 months ago, I became a rep for Maricel Solar out in Nokomis,
mm-hmm.
who's installing all over the state. And this past week, I've signed contracts with 4 homeowners to take them virtually off the grid.
Well, let's talk about another.
And it's affordable. Because basically they're replacing their electric bill with a monthly payment, which is about the same. But now, and it's a 12-year note. So now they've locked in what their electric costs will be for the next 12 years. And then they won't have one. And it's a 25-year parts and labor.
And what is the average upfront investment on those?
But it really depends on how much electricity you use. So,
Just give us an idea.
Well,
a range.
Anywhere from 20 to 40,000,
mm-hmm.
maybe as low as 15,000.
And they're financing it over like a 12-year period?
Right. And the federal government's giving you back 30%. FPL's giving you another $1,000. And when you finance it, you know, you have a choice. Do you want to make a payment for a coal? Because that's where most of our electricity
mm-hmm.
comes locally. Do you want coal for your electricity, or do you want the sun for your electricity?
And FPL uses more gasoline than people are aware of, too, in their plants.
They do
have gasoline.
And actually peak demand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Days like right now, during peak demand, someone at FPL is going, there's more demand. We need to increase capacity. Well, when you put a solar on your house, you just took yourself off that demand. So you
right.
put yourself
you're alleviating
off.
Demand, right.
And not only that, but you're actually producing during the day a lot more electricity.
So let's talk about
that.
Let's talk about that real quick. We've got a big decision that came out this week. or excuse me, not the committee this week, it's going to be heard in September by the Florida Supreme Court. So there is a movement to have a constitutional amendment, a ballot proposition in November 2016 to say, like other states, we want these people that do that to be able to sell some of their excess energy just to contiguous property, so just to neighbors who abut to your property. So the guy in front of you, not the guy across the street, the guy next to you, the guy on the other side, the guy behind you, you can sell excess energy to. So it could help offset that cost even more. That is illegal in Florida. It's not illegal in most states. So we're looking for a ballot proposition. A.G. Bondi, doing the bidding of the utilities, she's taken it to the Florida Supreme Court, and they will hear arguments on September 1st. She's fighting to have the amendment proposal not go on the ballot.
Right.
Yeah, so she's trying to say it's misleading.
Right now, let me tell you what's happening right now. Right now, the way we design a system for a homeowner, we're putting enough solar collectors on your house that you're basically producing a little more electricity than you're going to consume during the day. But so at night, during the day, your electricity is going out to your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
FPL takes it. The meter goes backwards, basically. It's actually 2 meters.
But they don't buy it back, do they?
Well, here, I'll explain. So your excess solar capacity goes back into the grid, and electricity is like water. It flows. Someone turns a light on, it pulls that electricity. So you're supplying solar power to your neighborhood. FPL is billing them for that electricity that you created. Now, at night, they're giving it back to you at the same cost. So they just replace the kilowatts. Except at night, it costs FPL less money to produce electricity when it's not peak demand than it does during the day. So, one, they're making out. And at the end of the year, in the end of December, so in January, you're going to get a check for a couple $100 back. But they're only paying you, if you don't use it, they're only paying you a wholesale, which is about 4 cents a kilowatt as opposed to 12 cents a kilowatt. Because if they were required to pay you what they charge you, then I would say to a homeowner, how big is your roof? Because there's a good return on your investment.
Right.
Where in other states, the utilities are required to pay for it. Now, if we had those carbon credits in that free marketplace, the solar on your roof would produce a huge carbon credit. You could probably actually sell the electricity, I read articles, for about 20 cents a kilowatt, which would make it real attractive for a homeowner than to cover their roof and use the most efficient collectors they can. And that would incentivize, and the utilities are scared of it. And one of their, which is a valid argument, they're scared if this gets too saturated, who's going to pay for the
grid? Who's going to support the grid infrastructure?
The grid.
Right.
And, you know, listen, when they get to a certain point, that built-in legislation saying when you get to a certain point, then we can bill for the grid because we should pay for the grid.
Sure. So that is a problem, but you know what? It's an inevitable problem. And like most inevitable problems, it's never going to get easier to transition. It is only going to get harder. It is only going to get more expensive. We cannot burn coal and gasoline forever. Nuclear is not the answer. Solar is.
Yep.
We're proving that.
And
look at the advances in solar in the last 5 years. Compare them to the advances in nuclear. That is the solution. It's never going to be easier today to start to transition. So let's hope that we continue to do the right thing. So I think that wraps it up for us, right?
Yeah, well, let me give out my phone number if you're interested in putting solar on your roof. It's 813-924-7994, and I'm Mitch Mallett.
Call Mitch Mallett. Become part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yeah,
and Boggy will be back on Monday, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, we're going to have Bud Beck here on Monday. And we're out of here, and we'll talk to you all next week.
ConstitutionMinute.com.
Colleges in the U.S. and Cuba are building new academic ties as tensions ease between the two countries.
Several American universities have recently agreed to host exchange programs with Cuba.